Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. I'm Cooper, and I have with me tonight...
Hi, it's Miko, and this is Ophelia.
We are talking about Season 2, Episode 12...
Tomewan.
There's a lot of fluctuation in your pronunciation there. That's why I can never pronounce any of these. It's just, I would pronounce it, I don't know, Tomewan.
Tomewan. You said Tomewan.
Tomewan.
Yeah, you said Tomewan.
Tomewan.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Tomewan Kenobi.
Tomewan Kenobi. Yeah, help for it to be Tome, it would have to be T-O-M-I.
T-M-I.
It's directed by Michael Reimer, written by Chris Brancato, Brian Fuller, and Scott Numerfro. And tonight we are drinking 19 Crimes red wine. It's an Australian red wine, and it's really good.
Yes, it is. Quite surprised,
I'm very much enjoying it.
Yeah.
I like, Miko, I like it when you go shopping for red wine, because you really work in theme.
Yes, I do.
So these are crimes that would get you exiled, I assume, to Australia at some point.
Yes, yeah. That's actually what it says.
Yeah.
Yes.
Isn't that offensive to Australians?
It's called transportation.
Well, no, that's the origin.
No, I know, but there are a lot of things that originally were the case in the United States that we'd rather not talk about anymore, so...
Well, that's true. It may not be something that they want to talk about a whole lot, but,
They do have a wonderful wine country.
Yeah, and that's why, in a way, I'm sort of not surprised. I said that when we were trying to figure out what it was. I just said red wine. I was like, they make excellent Shiraz.
Yeah.
There are very few Australian wines I have not liked.
In fact, I can't even name one.
One thing about Australian wines is that they are very strong.
13%.
Yes. Almost all of them are very strong, which makes me laugh because I believe there's a Monty Python skit that's about Australian fighting wines. So that's what Ronan and I always call a good Australian fighting wine.
Well, let's dive right in, because we're in the home stretch here.
Yes.
Will and Hannibal sitting in a session, and Will is just baiting Hannibal. Will has never seemed so confident as he does in this opening, talking about the snare that is around Hannibal's neck that he put there.
Yes.
And was curious what would happen.
Right. He is playing Hannibal's role.
Yeah.
He is. Oh,
completely. In this whole thing, I was curious. You know, and that whole thing I didn't care other than I wanted to see what you would do.
Yeah.
It's like he's completely throwing back all of that stuff.
And did you get the sense that Hannibal had a look of respect on his face when Will said that?
Oh, yes.
It's like, okay, yeah, I see what you're doing. I may not like it, but well played, sir.
We have upped the caliber of our banter.
Yes.
Yes. Well, the common theme to almost all of their conversations, even more so in this episode, is we are both alike.
Yes. Oh, in this episode, that's what this is about.
Exactly.
Is the duality here.
Yeah, right.
And so, especially after that moment in the last episode where we had them appearing as each other.
Yes.
So that hearing, when he's, why did you tell Mason that I wanted to kill him? Hmm. And the answer is, I was curious.
Yeah.
You know, was probably like, oh, he's just like me. Oh, heart a flutter.
Yes.
I'm sure there is a anime version of Hannibal's face on the internet with those giant eyes and the rosy cheeks, all
and
excited.
Hearts.
Yes.
Hearts coming out.
Because I have seen many.
I have seen
giant
many of those.
Anime Hannibal and Will exchanges.
After tonight, so can you.
Yes. Yay. Just so audience understands, if this episode maybe seems uncharacteristically brief, I don't know if it will, but it might.
It might.
It's because after this episode finishes recording, the moment I hit stop on that recorder, we are hitting play on the already queued up Blu-ray of the season finale.
Yes.
Final episode of season 2, final episode played so far, and that means tomorrow Miko will have nothing to do but go online and read all of the everything.
Exactly. I'm going to spend entire
the
day.
Fan fiction you will find.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Exactly. I will be free. It's like you threw me the sock.
And there are plenty.
Dobby is
plenty.
Free.
Yes, indeed. Dobby is free. We had a wonderful callback to the books with Discourtesy is Unspeakably Ugly to Me.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah,
and that is from Silence, because that's what he said after Miggs threw his enthusiasm all over Clarice Starling.
How very tasteful of you.
But Miko, what was it like to hear our opening from our podcast on the episode itself? One should always try to eat the root.
I was so enjoying this entire part. Everything starting from, you know, the Mason is discourteous, discourtesy is ugly to me. And then he goes right into whenever it's feasible. Yeah, I find it whenever it's feasible to eat the root. It was like, yes. And then he follows that up with, you know, will you join me at the table?
It was all right there.
And Will's line, I omitted from that because I didn't want to tip our hand that Will and Hannibal would be talking about eating people at the table.
Right.
Because that line, in my original cut of our opening musical thing, that
Will's
was in
voice.
It. But I pulled it out because it's like, that's going to reveal
something.
He's
going to give it away.
Yeah.
Too many spoilers.
Yeah.
My favorite part, before he says, would you join me at the table, was when Will says that Mason Verger is a pig.
Yes.
And he deserves to be someone's bacon.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I love that line.
Do you love it? I got the feeling that Will is almost overplaying his hand here. I think Will is riding a weird confidence high.
He is
under the impression that he has got Hannibal so well.
Megalomaniacal.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But then we get this fantasy.
He's drunk with power.
You know, where Hannibal asks Will to close his eyes and imagine what he hopes will happen. And we have Hannibal hanging as Will slits his throat and...
We get a money shot.
We get the money shot all over Will's face. We've got a bloody bukkake here going on, which is in fitting with the Asian theme.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
But I really liked the two times we see Hannibal trussed up like this in the episode, because it's almost identically mirrored to the end. Hannibal's expression is so neutral for something so frightening, something that to anyone else would mean, okay, well, you're done. Hannibal is accepting the fate. Even in Will's fantasy, Hannibal isn't upset.
No.
He isn't sad. He's just taking it.
What's interesting is how piercing his gaze is.
Yes.
So maybe in Will's fantasy, yes, but I feel like later on it's not necessarily that he's surrendering peacefully.
Oh, no. Hannibal is unafraid later on.
No, he's just... I think that's his calculated... He has to, you know, slow his heart rate so that he can think about how to get out of it.
Yeah.
Like, he's just...
He's hearing Goldberg variations in his
head?
Yeah,
exactly.
And he's just waiting for the moment, the opportune time to react, or the opportune time to get out, or he's seriously just looking at his opponents and trying to size them up.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and the music was so serene there. It was a little discordant. You know, we're used to this type of discordant sound from Brian Reitzel.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it's given this overlay of calm.
Yeah.
And it goes so well with the silent slow motion that we're getting here.
And the intense.
And those deep drums.
Look.
Just the death march drums there. Until the pigs start devouring Fantasy
and
Hannibal.
And then we get that pretty piano music.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we get the happy music when we come back to Will.
Yeah, we get
and
the
And Will
happy
doesn't
music.
Say anything. He's just... We haven't heard the happy theme in a long time.
Oh, in a long time. Yeah.
This is what we also used to call the Winston theme. This is the Will at peace theme.
Yes. With his sort of whimsical little bit of a smile.
Indeed.
Oh, yes, when he comes back to the office.
Yes.
When Hannibal asks what he saw,
he doesn't say it.
He's just a hint of a
smile. And then the smile comes very slowly. And then we get the one of the fastest cuts to the credits
we had a run of a few episodes where it was like 10-15 minutes in we were getting the credits,
yeah.
And so the last two have been within five,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, much shorter compared to the way it's been almost the entire season long, where it takes so long to get to the credits, the opening credits, that when we get there I'm like, oh, that's right, we have to do an opening credit.
Yeah,
right.
We haven't even really started yet.
I keep thinking we're in the episode.
It's like the Bond movies where we're a half hour in before we get the opening song. It's like, wow. Why bother?
Exactly.
So we come back from the credits, and Mason is at Hannibal's office for a session. Mm-hmm. And we start, there are two incredible split diopter shots in here,
mm-hmm.
with really, really close to the camera focus, as well as focus far away.
Yes.
So at the beginning, we see Hannibal sleeving a scalpel,
mm-hmm.
as Mason is critiquing his art with terrible trash. This one's pretty good. You know,
I love, like, they almost went out of their way after Hannibal just talks about how discourteous he is.
To remind us.
He just shows it just in force in the next couple of scenes. And that whole thing, and we've already seen other people see Hannibal's work.
Right.
And we have seen Hannibal's work.
And we know it's not terrible.
Beautiful. Exactly. And to see a terrible, you know, in that grating voice that he has. Yeah. And you could just, like you can tell that just Hannibal is just stewing.
So what this episode has to do at this point is prove to the audience, who may not be totally on board with what Hannibal does to Mason Verger, that he is deserving
of what Hannibal does. They have to make him so completely abhorrent that you're like, yeah!
And what's funny is this show, what makes him abhorrent is Mason stabbing Hannibal's chair, putting his feet up on Hannibal's desk.
Sitting at his desk and then putting his feet up. I think that whole thing, I think it was almost like the first insult is, you know, he insults his artwork, then he sits at his desk, and you can see a very, response.
Yeah.
From that. Then he puts his feet up, and it's sort of like it builds. And the rudeness upon rudeness while he's there.
I can see why that irritates Hannibal, but I'm happy to see what happens to Mason Verger just based on what he did to Margo.
Well, keep bringing that up. Yes, absolutely. But what this episode is doing is it's giving the audience these little jabs. The way Mason is testing the depth of the fat, the show is jabbing us with the knife. And we're just being like, yeah, Hannibal, would you kill him already? Good Lord.
It's a way of reinforcing it. It's like we've been building it up to this,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, we've seen him sort of do horrific things. Most of it we've heard about.
Yeah.
We know he's done terrible things to Margo.
Yes.
But I think this and is like, let's make sure you are completely aware of what a dick this guy is. Yeah, you know, we're gonna bring up the camp thing again.
When they're gonna talk about suffering in general.
Suffering, yeah, and then bringing up
you subverted me.
Right, exactly. And how he is just so annoying.
Petulant child.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I like how Hannibal just sits down. It's like, okay, well, Mason, I'm going to go over and sit in the therapy area.
Right. I'm going to go and act like a responsible adult. Yeah. I am working within the parameters in which we have set.
Of our agreement.
That you are not willing to do. And the mindlessness of his rudeness.
Yeah.
That he doesn't notice that he's, you know, those have to be expensive leather chairs.
Oh, God, yeah.
So
possibly irreplaceable antiques.
Exactly.
Those leather chairs, I imagine, cost more than my car.
Oh, totally.
When he said, oh, just send me the bill.
And then all of a sudden he looks down and he does that crazy ass laugh. Send me the bill. And it's so indicative of his whole life. That he pays people off.
Yeah, that it doesn't matter.
Throws money at people. And it's also indicative of the way his father probably treated him,
mm-hmm.
is that go and be as awful as as you want to, how he did terrible things in camp and he did all these other awful things, which probably came from his father being awful, but that then his father, rather than getting his son help or telling him not to do these things, just threw money at it.
Yeah.
You're
money
fine.
Solves the problem.
Yeah, exactly. So now he's grown up to be this, you know, crazy, you know, just whack job.
Yeah.
You know, who does not know how to function in society, and he's just so incredibly rude.
And then when Mason comes around the chair and shows him Papa's knife and just has such loving discussion of Papa's knife, and Hannibal again doesn't react despite the fact that the knife is at his throat.
Yeah.
But I loved the idea that Mason's like, oh, there's no fat on you.
Yeah.
And it would take more than a flesh wound
to make you squeal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. And I think what I love about this scene is we all know that Hannibal has the upper hand on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But here is woefully overconfident Mason.
Yes.
You know, walking around.
He is still under the impression that he is the big bad.
Exactly.
He thinks the show is called Mason Verger.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah, the show is Verger.
It's like that episode of Buffy where it's Jonathan in the opening credits and Jonathan's the hero of the show. Yeah.
Exactly. He is the hero in this, in his own mind here. Because the whole time, the way he's talking and about how, you know, Papa taught me how to hide things.
Yeah.
And it's there's this the overwhelming ego here.
Oh yeah,
that I can do anything I want to you because I've been taught how to hide things, and but then also having that moment of it's going to take a lot more than this to make you squeal, but almost like, well, I got your number, pal.
Yeah, don't worry.
Don't worry. Don't think what's the whole thing about, I'm good at playing chicken. I play chicken with Margot, but don't tell her.
I just don't tell her I'm playing.
Yes. I don't tell her I'm playing.
Well, yeah, because he's curious what kind of chicken that Hannibal and the sperm donor are playing with
him. Yes. I love that, the sperm donor. He won't even call him by name. Mm-hmm. This is all about his haughtiness and his, you know, his hubris, his ego.
Indeed.
His, you know, we're getting it in full force.
Well, Mason had a major success in his campaign in the last episode. And we see that as Wounded Margot dresses with that obscene belly scar.
It is a horrific looking scar.
That Mason wanted to remind her. Not to cross him,
because it could have been done arthroscopically,
right?
You know,
right.
And it's and it's very interesting. I know they had to put it up really high, you know, for television reasons, because to get to the uterus, you actually cut a little lower down, in the abdomen.
NBC would have had a problem with that.
Yeah. But you can cut in and get into, you know, having had two C-sections, you know, the scar you're left behind is really thin and, you know, and light, you know, it's basically they just staple it and it closes up. And they show this just horrific.
Well, it happened in that red room, you know, that may not have been a hospital.
That's true.
We have no idea where that was.
But the idea that. It he not only chose not to do it orthoscopically, but made it the most obvious and horrible looking scar imaginable. And knowing that doctors can do better than that was like, could this have been, it's almost like, I'm not going to hit you in the head with a 2x4 with this. I'm going to grab a freaking, you know, telephone pole and hit you with this idea. It's so horrifying to look at. She almost looks like she's not completely closed the way the wound is done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so she's showing this to Hannibal and Will, who, again, say, well, we need to kill your brother. But Margot presents the very obvious issue with that, is that Mason can't die. Or she loses everything.
Yeah.
Now that she can't have a baby, that's it. That game over there.
It's going to go to, was it the Baptist something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I loved Will's moment where he says to show her brother how strong she is by surviving him.
By surviving him.
Yes. And Hannibal has a pointed reaction there. Mm-hmm. You know, because Will is essentially showing Hannibal how strong he is by surviving this whole situation.
Mm. And then you have the moving on is a rebuke,
mm-hmm.
not a, what did she say? A solution or a resolution.
She was saying
there is no resolution to this. There is no, basically no peace for her.
Mm.
And Will was saying, well, there doesn't need to be, because moving on for you doesn't need to be a resolution. It just needs to be a rebuke and a way to show him how strong you are.
Yeah. It's hard. They have to build her back up. I mean, she's so defeated.
Oh, yeah. And she is just empty.
He always wins. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, she's tried so many times, and then to sort of fail in her mind so miserably. You know, she not only lost the child, but she lost, you know, a chance to have a child at all. You know, and so at this point, it's like, how do they build her back up after, you know, some of the terrible things that he's just done to her.
Then we wind up back at the FBI, where Will and Jack mm-hmm. finally discuss how wacky it is that the FBI ostensibly is endorsing the Randall, Tier, and Freddie Lowndes murders, whether or not Freddie is dead or not,
mm-hmm.
the FBI is on board with this whole plan. Well, at least Jack is on board.
Yes. Yeah, you can definitely tell. And it's funny because we did discuss this last time of, oh my God, how much do they know? Or are they, you know, and it also answered the question of Randall Tier that he will, you know, killed in self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
But then Jack's like, well, how the hell am I going to prove that? Because you mutilated the body.
And what am I supposed to tell people now? I'm telling them the bare minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way this goes away is by bringing Hannibal in.
Exactly.
That's the only way.
And with proof.
Yeah.
And this is, and the frustrating thing that's going on here is Will is like, I got a little bit, but he hasn't said anything yet.
Right.
And Jack is sort of like, we need him to either confess to something. We need evidence. We can't keep, because the bodies are going to keep piling up, and you are deep.
When the craziness of this plan in goading Hannibal into killing Mason, stopping him before he does it, mm-hmm. arresting Hannibal, this is Will being way overconfident.
Oh,
and again, reiterating that he's a good fisherman.
Oh, yeah. In which Jack's reply is, later on, is, I'm a good fisherman, too.
Yeah, and then he shows off his catch.
Mm-hmm.
The surprise guest of Gillian Anderson with Dr. Du Maurier, who has decided to speak even slower.
I love, again.
And quieter.
One of the beautiful things about this show has been people's interesting experimentation with speech pattern. And even it gives us the, you know, wonderful maniacal quality of Mason's speech pattern. Mm-hmm. And I know we have been extolling of the really interesting style that is Dr. Du Maurier.
Yes.
It's mesmerizing. It's got a, like a hypnotic effect to it.
One of Will's interesting traits in Red Dragon is that to make people he's talking to more comfortable, he adjusts his speech pattern
mm-hmm.
to sound like them.
Like them.
And this is a scene where we definitely get that
mm-hmm.
because Will is speaking slower and more deliberately and sounds a lot like Dr. Du Maurier in this scene.
Mm.
And he thanks her for the belief, for being there, for saying this to him.
For saying it to him. Yeah, and she doesn't think that she's done enough. You know, that it wasn't quite, you know. I think she's realizing by her being there that, you know, things have progressed and she, you know.
Yeah.
She's really worried for where Will is in this situation.
And really worried for where she is.
Yes, very, very much. I love how, when she's first in there, she's got that stunningly blood red, dark red
yes.
blouse on, a very Alana-esque print skirt on, and she's clutching her purse.
She may need to bolt at any moment. They could turn on the light behind the two-way mirror and Hannibal's standing there, and then it's over. Yeah. It's over.
It totally looked like that to me. Like, she's in there going, okay, I got to get out of here. Or like, okay, maybe they're just going to talk to me for a minute and I'm going to go. There is that sense of immediacy.
Yeah.
You know, that you know, she is sort of sitting upright. She's not very relaxed, and you can
would
see,
you be?
Yeah, and you can see in the shots when they do the turnarounds to her, you can see the handle of the purse in the shot, sort of against her chest, because she's got this, you know, little purse on the table, and she's just like clutching this purse, and it's not until she's told that she is given complete immunity,
yeah,
she takes the purse and she puts it on the floor. Like, well, I guess I'm going
to
be here.
She was prepared to say, good day, sir.
I said good day.
Well, you know, if she knew that the last guy we saw in the interrogation room got shot in the face.
Yeah.
She might be concerned.
Exactly.
So the line about some psychiatrists are so hungry for insight that they may try to manufacture it.
Yeah.
Isn't that lovely?
Everything she says in this is really interesting. You know, just because, you know, the whole idea that there is a confusion after a while of who is the patient and who is the doctor.
Yeah.
And that Will is sort of like, well, you know, you weren't the patient. He was the patient.
And she says that she talked herself into believing
into
that.
Into believing yeah. that.
Right.
You know, and that, you know, that she was, I was under his influence.
I love the discussion of influence because that is such a perfect metaphor for, I mean, that not metaphor, that's a perfect example of what Hannibal does, is he influences things, even though he's trying to play the godlike role and just seeing what happens, he can't resist nudging a church down onto a whole bunch of old ladies, you know?
It's not coercion, it's persuasion.
It's persuasion, yes.
And the whole discussion of her patient.
Yes, who died swallowing his tongue, just like multiple MIGs in the next cell.
I know, I wrote that down and was like, oh, book reference. Tongue.
Well, and the tongue swallowing thing is one of those things where you cannot actually swallow your tongue.
No.
You can't kill yourself by swallowing your tongue. Mm-hmm. And so right away, she mentions that it wasn't attached.
When he swallowed it. And that because, you know, she has got this immunity, she comes right out and says, I killed him.
Mm-hmm.
I believed it was self-defense, which I thought was very much exactly what Will was saying to Jack about Randall Tear.
Yeah. Well, and the same part, to a point, it was self-defense, but beyond that point, it was murder.
It was murder. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And that she's convinced that he influenced her to murder. I love it. It was like our patient.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it was both his and our patient. Yeah. It very much is calling, it's bringing it all together. All the stuff that we've seen Will go through. We can thoroughly see that in her explanation of what she did. We're seeing the pattern.
And then she says that Hannibal will try to persuade him to kill somebody he loves, and that he will think it is the only solution.
Mm-hmm. Now, I thought that was an interesting thing to say. I don't know if it's because she has some insight into what Hannibal's specifically manipulating Will to do, or what. Where would she get that idea? Did she love this patient that he killed?
That's an intriguing possibility.
That's the thing that I was thinking.
It could also be the fact that, I mean, we know how some of what Dr. DeMaurier knows about the case, because as Hannibal's psychiatrist, she heard enough about Will and Alana and Jack Crawford. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, she could just be surmising that Will is going to be convinced to kill Alana or Jack Crawford, right. Which is really, those are our options at this point. Those are the people he loves, sort of in Alana's case at this point. So really it's Jack Crawford or, I don't know, Winston.
And aw, Winston.
But as Brian Fuller has said, he will never kill one of the dogs. I'm going to go ahead and assume it's not Winston.
Okay. Winston is safe.
So let's talk about the wonderful description of how Hannibal will get caught.
Yes.
Because this is one of my favorite things in the entire episode. Uh-huh. And this is an episode full of awesome things.
Oh, it is.
But he can get lost in self-congratulation of his own exquisite taste and cunning.
Yes.
And whimsy is what will get him caught.
Will get, he will get caught. And I like the way she said it, too.
Yes.
Whimsy.
It's sort of like Hannibal does a victory lap before he's actually won.
Yes.
You know, like he is so on board. And it's kind of what Will is doing in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Will is so convinced of his strategy that he's tipping it to everybody.
Yes.
So,
and that could be his undoing.
It's another bit of that duality between the two of them.
Oh, definitely.
So we return to Will and Hannibal in therapy. And get just a batshit line.
Oh, I love it so much.
We are maintaining our position on the event horizon of chaos.
I was like, I want a website where that's the title. I don't know what it would be.
Horizon of Chaos would have been a great podcast name. There are two great podcast names in this episode. I don't remember what the other one is, but I will get there. But that would have been a great one.
Most definitely. I love it.
And Hannibal's discussion about, Will and Hannibal talk about dreams, mm-hmm. and that dreams prepare us for waking life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so interesting because if we look at what Will does, his empathy disorder as dreams, his fantasy world, mm-hmm. and we look at the Wendigo as equivalent of dreams and that fantasy world, then we're assuming that all of these visions are preparing him for the true horrors of his actual life.
Of what, yeah.
And whether or not they've actually prepared him or not for it, you know?
Well, it's, you know, because Will was like, so much about this feels like a dream.
Yeah.
You know, that he's...
Well, and the show feels like a dream at this point.
Oh,
we're in such a surreal point in the show, and it only gets more surreal.
And we've gone back to shooting everything super dark.
Yeah.
We're moving a lot of color out of entire scenes. A lot of scenes that are lit from one really small light source somewhere in the back of the room.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah,
with the one-on-one partial faces and the shadow. Mm-hmm. It looked almost like the hollows of Will's eyes were blacked out. When it was on his face. And uh-huh. it was blackness with only, like, you could see the lower jaw and a part of mm-hmm. his forehead. But it's like he was submerged in the darkness just enough to where, like, half of his face was obscured.
It's Rembrandt to the max.
Mm. And then you got the same where you change camera angles and it's Hannibal's face and he's also... But... Not as partially obscured, mostly just his face was visible. But it looks like disembodied heads. Or like a skin mask of mm-hmm. them. And they definitely gave you this sort of the eerie feel.
Well, especially if it's a skin mask. If you're given this idea of a face removed, mm-hmm. you know, and not in the fun Nicolas Cage / John Travolta way, where he wants to take his face off.
I can't believe we just did a face-off reference.
Hey, face-off is amazing.
I have a friend of mine who kept trying to convince me to watch that movie, and I couldn't make it through. You know what's another great, like, face-off moment is RoboCop, when he takes the helmet off.
That's true.
He's got the skin right.
We're going to totally watch Face Off instead of the finale.
No, we're not.
So, Mason is a problem.
Yeah.
And problem-solving is hunting.
Oh, there is so... much awesome in the dialogue.
Yes.
In the, you know, and it's tough because you don't, you know, we don't want to keep continually quoting, but this episode is so much beauty in words.
Well, and it does the thing that this show does really well that is totally the least realistic dialogue in the world, where mm-hmm. somebody says an obscure thought, and it's followed up by an obscure, somewhat tangential thought, mm-hmm. and then it goes back to another obscure thought. Like, we started this scene with a discussion of the event horizon of chaos. Who the fuck talks like that?
Exactly.
And why do we love it so much? Why is it so amazing? Mm-hmm. Because it's poetry. It's almost Shakespeare.
Yeah.
It's these heady thoughts that aren't even really, it's not even really dialogue. It's almost, someone could break out into verse at any moment.
Because it's giving you a lot more than just conversation.
Yes.
Yeah,
which is exactly what a show like this needs and can excel at.
Yes. And we can take this dialogue with two, you somewhat sort of expect it from a character like Hannibal, but Will is, every man. And he winds up coming up with beautiful ways of, expressing things. And the lovely sort of back and forth, the banter and the parries that, that he does with Hannibal, especially now that we're heading into a crescendo here.
And this is where Will really takes the gloves off, that Hannibal doesn't want him to have anything in his life but him, and calls into the fact that he bonded with Abigail mm-hmm. and Beverly, and Hannibal took them, and he alienated him from Alana and Jack. Mm-hmm. So really, it's just Will and Hannibal.
And it answers our question of whether or not Hannibal purposely told Mason to get rid of the baby. Although this is Will suspecting that that's what he did. But that very same question that we proposed last week, Will isn't even asking a question. Will is like, yeah. No, I cared about this thing, this concept that was a baby. It was barely even a child. And you took that from me. And so, exactly. It's like, you don't want me to have anything in my life that's not you.
And that, exactly, that's the exact point that I was trying to make last week with what we were. And I don't know, maybe subconsciously I was remembering this, because it was before we had watched this.
Right.
Maybe I was remembering a part of that, but I was so convinced that that's exactly what Hannibal was doing, and it made me so angry.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. That he doesn't there's no limit.
Mm.
No.
No, none at all.
There is no limit.
And I'm so happy that Will really, this is another example of maybe Will's overplaying his hand, mm-hmm. or maybe he's playing into the idea that Hannibal would be suspicious if Will wasn't suspicious of him.
Mm.
And when Will says, every moment of cogent thought under your care is a personal victory.
Victory.
And that harkens back to the first thing I ever heard about Hannibal Lecter, which is, you don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head.
Your head, yeah.
Which is what Jack Crawford tells Clarice Starling at the beginning of Silence. Don't tell him anything personal mm-hmm. because you don't want him in your head. And it's so great to see that. It's like the horror of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the acknowledgement that Will's been drowning. And this drowning, he's finally able to gasp at the surface. And the surface is this cogent thought.
Right.
And that's where he sees all these things about the bonding and the way they are just alike. Because they're both so very alone without each other. And the loneliness of mm-hmm. each other. And that harkens back to the discussion of that the devil is terribly lonely. Because he was cast out of paradise. Mm-hmm. And all because he wanted more than he had.
Mm-hmm.
And so it everything follows.
It just follows, yeah. And it's also, again, continuing that connection that Will is making with Hannibal, and that, we are both the same, as Hannibal says earlier, when he's like, you're alone as I am. So giving him, drawing him in with that whole, again, with that idea that, you and I have this, we're simpatico here.
Yeah. <know? laughs> And there was one more line in there about applying yourself to my perspective as I've been applying myself to yours.
To yours, yeah. There's so much in here. It's almost like you can't help but bring it to the forefront and bring it out there.
Indeed.
Because it is. It's beautiful language.
So we have another scene with Dr. Demoriel and Jack, where they talk about loneliness and Hannibal's loneliness. And Jack's sort of desperation, especially at this point, he's gone so far down the rabbit hole that he needs to believe this is all going to work out in the end.
Exactly.
Because if it doesn't, it's worse than the end of last season where Jack just kept a theoretical serial killer on his payroll for a long time.
Yeah.
So now he's been sanctioning killing.
How does he then justify, you know, all of what he's put in and have nothing come out of it? And then also the cleanup. Like, is he going to have to deal with, you know, the sort of the outcome of letting Will loose, how things have not gone, you know, exactly the way he would like them to?
Well, I think Jack is really to a point of he is not comfortable with as far as it's gone.
No.
But he is past the point of no return. You know, the windmill is in his rearview mirror in his DeLorean. He is on his way to the gulch, and he needs to keep going, because at this point, there's no, you either do it now, or you lose all chance. It's like, if you pull up that bait, and the fish knows it was bait, then
it's over.
There's no other. Yeah. They may never get another chance.
You have to sit it out. And it's really hard for him to be patient right now.
Yeah.
You know, he's really chomping at the bit, and that could really undo things. Like you said, if he pulls that bait out too soon, or even just jerks a little too much and shows his hand.
Yeah.
You know, he has to be that good fisherman. He has to sit there, and as much as he's in a panic about how things could go wrong if he doesn't get this confession, or if he doesn't get some kind of proof, or get Hannibal sort of lured into a trap, then it will all be for naught, and he will just have, you know, a hell of a cleanup.
Indeed. Mm. And Dr. Demoriel gets another wonderful line that really is like the thesis statement of the last two episodes here. If you think you're about to catch Hannibal, that's because he wants you to think that. Don't fool yourself into thinking he's not in control.
In control of what's happening. Oh, it's sort of like this whole, you know, I love that she says, the only crime I witnessed is influence.
Yeah.
And I love that line because it comes after basically Jack telling Will, I need some proof.
Yeah.
And
Hannibal suggesting you kill somebody is not enough to arrest him.
Exactly. Exactly. And here is Dr. Demoriel basically saying that I didn't even see any crime other than his influence. So, you know, it's like, okay, he is so good at what he does that no one ever sees exactly what it is that he's doing. And you probably will not see it. And then she's also concerned for Will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that maybe, you know, Will doesn't know himself as well as Hannibal does. And it's almost like a warning to Jack that be careful, because Will may think that he's fooled Hannibal, but Hannibal may know Will better than he knows himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we get to symbolic dinner.
Symbolic dinner with the fish and aspic. Oh, yeah.
Jack parrying just as well as Will in this situation. Yeah.
And there, everything in this is painting. It's no longer subtle anymore.
No, this gelatin dish, aspic dish, a dish whose outcome can never be predicted because it's created upside down and it has to solidify in the right way. And it's so, I mean, it is all symbolic.
Oh.
There's no literalness in this show anymore.
It's Hannibal. Hannibal's coming right out and saying to Jack, the outcome cannot be predicted.
Yeah.
It's just like, hello, we're not talking about fish and aspic right now.
And the eternal chase. Unclear who is pursuing whom.
Yes.
And I like that Jack is even playing with Hannibal here. Mm-hmm. And so, what moment are we in now?
Now.
You, yes. Me, and Will.
Exactly. Like, okay, where are we in this pursuit? Do you know? And the only thing he knows is that he's I'm convinced in a general lack of trust.
Yes. But we get the most, this is Hannibal whipping his dick out and putting it on the table.
Yeah.
Whomever is pursuing whom at this very moment, I intend to eat them.
Eat them, yes.
Because that means he is not part of the equation.
Yes.
He is above the equation, and he is going to eat whomever he needs to eat.
Exactly. He is outside of things, looking in. I'm actually not one of the people that is being pursued. You are just under the illusion.
I'm not a tiny fish in this jello dish.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you are.
Well, I like that we go right from this, which starts with the food preparation,
yes,
to another sequence of food preparation where Will is preparing a very fancy breakfast for his dogs.
Yes.
It looks like rice and eggs and meat, and even there was what appeared to be a roast in there.
Well, and what was interesting, it looked like the same jawbone that Hannibal had used earlier.
It did look like the same jawbone.
Yeah. So they kind of...
Which looked like the pig. Maybe it's the leftovers of that pig.
The pig that Hannibal chose himself.
Indeed.
That Mason offered.
So one thing that I really liked about this sequence is the little dog is okay.
Mm-hmm.
The little dog that Randall Tier whacked or...
Yeah, he's very prominent.
Scratched, yeah.
Out on the porch.
He's there... He's okay. Doesn't seem to be walking with a limp. Doesn't have one of those little dog back leg scooters.
Oh. I'd be really impressed if they could get the dog with the limp.
Wow.
While Will is out feeding the dogs, Mason arrives to pick Will up in one of those Dennis Hopper let's go for a ride moments that are so terrifying.
And what apparently looks like is Papa's limousine.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was an old limousine.
And then Hannibal is also picked up by a trio. You know, Will gets a driver and Mason.
Yes.
Hannibal has Carlo Matteo, who's from the book,
who's
Hannibal.
From the book. Carlo's
and
brother.
And miscellaneous other guy.
Yes, who is named in the book, and we know learn more about him. But here, he's unnecessary. They're just the Sardinian trio.
Indeed. And I love how they speak Italian right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannibal does his Bartleby the Scrivener impression by saying, I'd prefer not to.
Yes.
And then Matteo gets it in the thigh in the most gruesome moment. Like, you don't even expect, because you hear the stab,
yeah,
but you don't get an idea of what's happening until Matteo goes and pulls it out,
and then all of that blood, which is how he is dispatched in Hannibal.
And that is what happens in Hannibal.
Yeah, yes. That is what happens in Hannibal. They set this up, the whole relationship. You get backstory on Carlo and Matteo and who they are.
Mm-hmm.
They're around, but it's also the difference between where they're putting Mason now in the timeline, where feeding him to the pigs is not as a result of his coercion or persuasion,
right,
that happens under the influence of the hallucinogenics, where when he comes to get his revenge, he wants to put Hannibal in the pig pen. And the whole thing, he wants to sit him down and have the pigs eat his feet first,
right,
and keep him alive as long.
His little piggies.
That was so chilling. And so because it's about post-mutilation Mason and his entire pursuit, Carlo is there from the beginning because he's basically his leg man.
Right.
And they give you the whole history of how he's been developing the pigs and training them and breeding them and the whole complicated thing. And they make the relationship between Carlo and his brother very important.
Yeah.
Because...
They were hired because of the pigs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, yeah. They were like well-known sort of mobster assassins to begin with, but they also knew how to deal with the pigs.
Right.
And they were able to do all that stuff and put the body with the food in it, and they knew how to train the wild pigs to eat the body, because the pigs would not actually... not necessarily do it naturally, because pigs have been known to do it.
Right.
But
get them to piranha the body.
Right, exactly. And the reason why they go through all that is it is something that Hannibal uses against Carlo mm-hmm. when he is escaping. And he basically, specifically kills Mateo to do like a big fuck you to Carlo, because he knows how strong the family ties are. And he does it in this really like, sort of slick and almost more cruel way, in that Mateo may have survived if he hadn't pulled the knife out.
Sure. And that's exactly what happens
so
here.
So they take that big, long, complicated storyline, and they put it in like 2 minutes. But they do it well.
But it's another great example of economy of storytelling.
Yes.
And reappropriating something that almost goes better here.
Yes. You don't need, because as much as I enjoyed Hannibal, it is a long way to get to certain things.
There's a lot of filler in Hannibal.
There is a lot of it. So I like how they took sort of the best parts of it.
Yeah.
And worked it in very nicely, because I wasn't sure how they were going to work in Mason Verger, you know, pre-mutilation. And even though we know that they were in therapy, it's not something that is talked about for an extended period of time in the book.
Except for that wonderful moment where we get to see Gary Oldman take the poppers and start to cut his face
and
off. Which is amazing that this TV series on NBC is showing us something far more gruesome than the movie Hannibal,
mm-hmm.
an R-rated, big-budget horror movie, ostensibly,
yeah.
was able to show us.
Well, Hannibal is showing the success. It's the Jaws mystique
mm-hmm.
is what they have captured in this. That what they had planned to show would not have been as frightening
right.
and as gruesome as how little they showed.
Because they couldn't show.
Exactly. It actually saved them. And whereas they're fettered in some way, because it is network television and not a rated R film, the fact that they show us a lot of blood, but it's really blood. Dark black
yeah.
blood, but our brains are filling it in. And every bit of thing that they show you, from what the pigs are doing, from Carlo coming out, from what our brains are filling. I was curled up in torture.
Oh, I know. I've never seen and you affected like that.
I am not squeamish. I will watch the most graphic, you know, slasher
yeah.
stuff and not turn away. I have been known to eat Chinese food while watching. A friend of mine thought that was horrific, that I
yeah.
was sitting through this really hard, graphic horror movie, and I was eating food like this. How can you even eat? But it got me, because my brain's filling it in. It's showing me just enough. It's giving me sounds.
Yeah. Squishy sound is really upsetting in this episode.
And knowing.
And you hear the dogs licking up a lot. We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yes. Okay.
Hannibal's trussed up.
Yes.
Just like in Will's Dream.
Yes.
Like identical.
It is identical. Like they shot it all at the same time.
And Hannibal can't help himself. And it's that whimsy we talked about.
Yeah.
Where Hannibal asks if Mateo fouled himself. Which
yeah.
is, it. You know, you think about that, and you think about Dr. Du Maurier's line about the whimsy, and it's the same thing as when he's on the wheel dolly in front of Senator Ruth Martin and says, toughens the nipples, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean,
he literally cannot help himself.
Oh, he has to just goad him and then not only insult his brother, but then insult him that he probably smells as bad as you do now. Which again, I mean, there was something they used to bring up in Hannibal, was that Carlo had this sort of smell of like sausages, and that he sort of had a rather like rough and foul scent about him that Hannibal really disliked. So it kind of touched on that. But it's also that, like, here he is trussed up, and it's like, yeah.
Just completely nonplussed.
I may be here, but I killed your brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, no matter what you do to me, brother's still dead.
Your brother's still dead. Yeah.
And we get a return of Mason's, we could have had some good, funny times together.
Oh my god, he said that and I laughed out loud. Oh, good, funny times.
And I love the, it's almost an action movie moment, where Will has the knife, and he almost cuts Hannibal's throat until Mason stops him.
Yeah.
And you wonder if Will was actually going to cut Hannibal's throat there.
Oh, and I love the little, now just a nick, don't bleed him out. Yeah.
And then spins him around, slices the back, gets hit in the head by Carlo, and out cold.
Out cold. And then, movie magic, stuff happens while Will...
And I like that we see a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Like, as he's going out of focus, we see Hannibal's straitjacket moving. So Hannibal is down and moving and engaged. He's part of the fight now.
Yes. And then when Will awakens, there's the evidence of the carnage. And what was unnerving about him waking up is that it had that the higher pitched whirring sound.
Yeah, we got two variations on the whirring, too, here. So we see the blood on the floor, and Will pulls the conveyor thing, the winch up.
Mm-hmm.
And as Carlo's remains are coming up, that's where I really heard the whirring.
Yeah.
And
it actually starts when he gets up.
Yeah.
It's a high pitch. It's not the deeper... thunderous whirring that we usually hear.
Right.
It's the same feeling, but it's like an octave higher. But it's still
very unsettling,
visceral feeling, and it's him sort of, and that whole almost like, is this a dream moment for Will? That he's been out and he's up and there's blood all over the place, and everyone's gone. And it almost seems like he's in a dreamlike state, but he's not. And lifting up the winch and proving that, I guess, to him that Hannibal definitely got free, because we only see half of Carlo.
Yes.
Again.
The top half.
Incredibly gruesome.
Incredibly gruesome. They get away with that by just having, you don't see body viscera. You see shredded clothing.
Yes.
And that is that's a trick in film and in horror to show something horrible, like losing an arm or something, but instead it's just, the sleeve flopping and the sleeve is bloody.
What I found was interesting, and they did this with Mason too, is that I really noticed this the second time, was that if you look at when they do the shot from far away, so that you get to see the whole thing with the pig the pens underneath, and him and the shredded clothing and how everything is all black and it looks like he's covered in blood. There is, I want to say texture that looks like his intestines are exposed. You don't know. It's like it's not. It's not. Definite.
Right.
But it's on the side. There's a little bit of side light. There's a little bit of that doesn't look
the
like
glistening.
The shirt. Yeah. That's kind of bubbling in a way. And my mind filled it in.
Yeah.
And
that's what this show does so well.
Yeah. I really felt like I was looking at him not all, but in half, and his insides half out. And it really gave me the impression that I was seeing more than I was actually seeing.
We start with really extreme close-ups of sweat. And then Mason is awakened with a very odd music in the background. And it doesn't really accelerate until Hannibal pumps up this chamber, this aerator, and gives Mason a shot of something.
A mix of some sort of hallucinogenic compound.
Yeah, he just describes it as a variety of psychedelic compounds.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting the way that they show the molecules going in and the reaction of the dilating of the vessels.
And the heart.
And then the heart rate increase.
And the heart rate becoming the beat of this crazy, wacky music. It's
like funhouse music.
And then you see the dilating of the eyes, all the traditional hallucinogenic triggers.
And Mason's, I want a prescription for this, doctor.
Yes.
Do you have any idea what this could be?
In a powdered form like that?
See, it was yellow. Isn't that heroin?
Heroin's not a
psychedelic, though.
No.
Yeah, it's a depressive.
Yeah, no, heroin would just make you feel like you've had 10,000 orgasms.
That's not. Whatever this is making Mason enchanted and terrified.
Yeah,
this is... Okay, so there are several things. LSD, usually not administered that way. But he wants, obviously, Mason to feel this immediately. He doesn't want to take the time. Acid takes time.
Could it be?
And he wants him to be very susceptible.
I have a feeling Hannibal has a way of getting a hold of peyote or mescaline.
Yeah, I just think it's probably an opiate.
No, those aren't opiates.
Of the They're masses?
No. Nope. Peyote is what Native Americans use. Mm-hmm. That's part of a extract from a cactus that you hallucinate. Okay. And then mescaline is an actual compound that I know a lot of animals who hunt at night produce.
Isn't that
humans
what cats
can produce
wind up with?
Cats.
You know your crazy cat in the middle of the night?
Yes. Mescaline is something that actually it's produced by the brain, so it can be synthesized. It's actually what Jacob's Ladder is based on, giving the troops something that will accelerate their alertness. But part of that side effect is seeing things that aren't there.
So then it's quite appropriate that they had a Jacob's Ladder moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
In the scene.
And the spinning of Hannibal's head and becoming the Borat.
Right out of Jacob's Ladder.
Yes.
Boy, Jacob's Ladder is a great movie. You at home, if you haven't seen Jacob's Ladder...
But
rent it.
It'll mess you up.
Honestly, I think he had to have given him more than just hallucinogens. Because in order to make him susceptible to suggestion and also to be, I'm guessing, numb to the pain, or at least be so hyped up that he doesn't feel
that it doesn't
the
matter,
pain,
yeah.
There's got to be maybe some PCP in there, maybe some sort of, I don't know, the medication that Chilton liked to use.
Oh, yeah.
Some sort of blend.
For the psychic driving.
Yeah.
Something that makes people more susceptible to suggestion.
Yeah. I mean, acid would do that. I don't know anything about peyote and mescaline. I just know that they'll make you see a lot of things that aren't there.
And make you willing to show Hannibal how to check the depth of fat on himself.
On himself.
Yeah. And also admit to wanting to kill
both of them. Yeah.
Will right after killing. He's admitting the truth too, so he's he's able to get access to his hidden thoughts, not just.
Yeah, it really it's turning off his filter and allowing him to tell him exactly what to do and have Mason think it's the best idea in the world.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
You know, in the book, we actually have Hannibal saying, why don't you cut your face off?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, he breaks a mirror and hands him the shard of mirror. and says, yeah. Why didn't you cut your face off? But in this one, we instead cut away and have Will walk, who walked home from Mason's house, apparently.
And poor Winston waiting at the door.
But this is what I love.
Winston is having none of it.
This is the episode where I hit on the idea that Winston is the goodness in Will. Mm-hmm. Winston is a conscientious objector to all the cannibals inside. Winston is taking the stand that Will is not taking.
The dogs aren't cannibals.
No, I know. I'm saying the dogs are representative of the cat.
Okay, sure. Mm-hmm.
And so Winston is sitting outside because he's reminding Will, you are better than this.
Than the people in there.
And there's something horrible happening in here. Yeah.
That the dogs are, you know, sort of give in to their, the sort of the deeper
animalistic
part
urges.
Of their nature. Exactly. Yeah. Because it's food and it's delicious. I don't care where it comes from. Whereas Winston has decided not to partake and is outside, you know, so that by the time Will gets up...
and I love that he's outside.
It's crazy train in there, man.
I picture Winston pawing at the door and Hannibal saying, okay, you go outside.
Exactly, right. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Right. Like, how did he get outside? There's no doggy door that I can see.
I also find it interesting. It's like going back to before Will gets there, when we have the Jacob's Ladder moment with the faces, that Hannibal becomes the boar's face.
Yes.
You know, with the
and the sparks are flying behind him.
And the sparks are all over the place. And then those frightening moments where Hannibal smiles.
Yeah.
It's like everything about all of the Mason POV that we're seeing here.
The surreality of it all
is
wonderful.
Yeah, it's surreal and horrifying all at the same time. And you don't really, truly realize that it's Will's.
Right.
If you're not really paying attention...
Well, you get that moment where Hannibal tells him not to upset the animals.
Yeah.
And Mason looks down and sees a... pig.
Mm-hmm.
But that pig is a dog.
He's a dog.
We know that pig is a dog because he's at Will's.
Yeah.
We just don't know it at that moment.
At that moment. Exactly. We don't know for sure until Will goes in and we see just the hand holding
Flesh. Well, what are you feeding my dogs?
What are you feeding?
Just me.
Yes.
And Mason has that little story about loving the dogs because he had to. And he put them in a cage without food and fresh water, and then basically one dog died and the other ate him.
And the other one had a warm meal. Oh!
Horrible.
Oh, Mason.
And then Hannibal is there.
And then he was like, I should have put you and Hannibal in a cage.
Yes.
He wanted to see what would have happened or who would have come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, there's so much. It's just the whole thing of just cutting his face and again... You see, and Ophelia and I were talking about this, what really was disturbing was that you got the hint of the bear teeth.
Yes. It's the same disturbing feeling you get from Randall Tears on inhuman teeth.
Yes.
And it really is just, it's upsetting. Mm-hmm. And you don't even know why it's upsetting. But it's because you're seeing a human being with a smile that a human should never have.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, sort of deep down in your core, this is just wrong.
Yeah. It's almost like the Glasgow smile in season one. Mm-hmm. Just, it's upsetting because it's unnatural and, just unacceptable.
Yeah, and then to have sort of Will and Hannibal having this conversation.
About broadening palates.
Yes.
Because Mason is broadening the dog's palates.
He's feeding himself to my dogs. Well, he's broadening their palates as I broaden
yes,
yours.
Indeed.
Oh.
And
I'm
Hannibal
hungry.
Has no patience for Mason.
No.
Because, he says, I'm hungry.
I'm hungry.
And Hannibal says, eat your nose then.
Yeah. He's like, oh, like, wow, what a brilliant idea. Don't mind if I do.
Tastes like chicken gizzard.
Tastes like chicken gizzard. Oh, I know.
Or the taste and the texture.
I have the taste and the texture.
The taste and consistency.
Yes. And then he's like, I'm full of myself.
Yes.
And he just burps thinks, first.
He thinks
you got
hilarious.
the little baby
and he thinks he's the funniest guy in the world.
Oh, I just want to clarify.
So you found some drug facts.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that the peyote that I was referring to actually, it is from a flowering cactus, but it is what contains mescaline.
Oh,
so
there you
go. That is what the Native Americans would inhale.
That's from the vision burning. Quest things, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. It could be chewed, boiled, drank, smoked. Yeah. You name it, it can be done. Basically, it just depends on what you're, if you're fresh picking it, you'd probably eat it.
Right.
If you dry it out, make powder, it could be inhaled or smoked.
And then Hannibal tries to get Will to kill him. And yes. Will turns him around and says, he's your patient, doctor.
Mm-hmm. You do what you think is best.
Is best. Oh, and again, just, oh, the sound of him.
The neck breaking?
The neck breaking. And, oh, and I love the way he just wipes his hands on Mason's shirt.
After checking his pulse.
Yeah.
To make sure he's still alive.
Mm-hmm. But that is not the end for Mason.
What a scene.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when we first realized that Mason Verger was in this season, you know, when we first had that Margot moment.
I think we all knew this was coming. Well,
it had to be.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole point of Mason Verger.
Yeah.
Without that, you don't bother. Mm-hmm. So to know that that couldn't really be the finale... Because the finale is probably going to be very much about Hannibal and Will. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen that it's at least a little bit about a Hannibal-Jack throwdown.
Oh, you know that's coming.
Then this has to be its own thing. So this is like, I go back to Buffy, but oftentimes there'd be that penultimate episode climax. And so that's what we get here. We get this crazy storyline. Mm-hmm. He's the little bad. Being dispatched because Hannibal is the big bad of his own series,
like Angel and Spike.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And it's also a time where the two of them were in the room with a possible victim.
Yes,
because so far that has not happened.
I love Drusilla.
He's always been on his own, and now they get to deal with.
They're sharing a moment.
Exactly, we get to deal with. This thing together, as opposed to Hannibal sending Will alone or Hannibal taking care of it alone, you know, and they're going to have this experience together.
So we come back to the eel.
Yes.
Who we learn is a brutal moray.
Brutal moray. Would you like to know why?
Yes. But Jack.
No, thank you.
Doesn't
need to
know.
Politely declines. Yes.
So Mason's story. Is that he tripped and fell into the pig pen, broke his neck, and the pigs ate his face. Yeah.
I fell down some
clumsy
stairs.
Clumsy me.
I fell down some stairs and hit the doorknob on my eye.
Right, exactly. If my sister hadn't have found me,
the
pigs would have eaten more than just my face.
I love, the face shield.
Yeah.
The weird ventriloquist mask looking thing. That was a digital post-production alteration.
Really?
They shot it with Mason's face just being bandaged. And no one liked the way it looked. Oh. So in post, and there's concept art and there's frames of three different mask versions. One that's all white with that weird face on it. And they said the flesh tone one is so upsetting.
Yeah.
And it is, because it is very much a ventriloquist dummy. Like, one of the ones that don't move their mouths.
Yeah.
Which are more upsetting than the ones that do move their mouths.
I found upsetting was the pinning up of the clothes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was
he's still
weird.
A fancy boy.
Yes.
Yeah. But you could tell that they were, like, almost, like, stapled to him.
Yeah.
Or stapled to the bed around him. It was just very oddly fitting. It wasn't like he was wearing the clothes.
And even the bed seemed oddly shaped. And it almost looked... It made me think of... if you look at photographs of, like, 18th century French royal bedrooms. Mm-hmm. Like the king's.
Yeah.
The beds usually look inordinately short.
Yeah.
There was a whole theory that it's because people were smaller back then, but now that they've done more research, they're thinking it probably wasn't that people were, because they really weren't that much smaller.
Right.
Yes, humans were a little bit smaller.
But not notably.
Progressively becoming, but not that much. They're thinking that people probably just slept propped up more for health reasons, and that's why the beds were shorter.
Well, so because Mason really, I'm sure he cannot be allowed to lie down anymore.
So one of the reasons, so seeing him propped up in that very 18th century, like King Louis-esque bed, that was the first thing I thought
with
of.
With the fancy, it was like a powder blue pattern on it.
The actual print was very French, 18th century. Yes, it's like he could have been the Dauphin sitting upright in bed with the curtains around him and everything. So that I thought was a great, and I love that the cover was blue, keeping with our, because he hasn't been in that palette.
No, he hasn't.
He's been in neutrals and whites, and when he went to the appointment where he threatened Hannibal, was the only, I think the only time in therapy he wasn't wearing white, he's wearing dark gray.
Oh yeah, he was.
Yeah. But always very, so to see him in that frosty blue 18th century Baroque looking, cover, it really did. It made it like he was trussed up like a French king. And I thought that the plastic mask thing was on purpose.
It was on purpose. It just wasn't on purpose when they shot it.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I thought that it was for that scene.
Yeah.
That was the idea originally. Only because, from what I remember from the book, because I haven't watched the Hannibal movie yet, and I need to.
You've never watched it?
Nope, I never watched it.
Oh, well,
I have it. I have it on my DVR upstairs.
Oh, I have it Blu-ray.
Since the summer, I keep saying I'm going to watch it. And it's all my memories are from the book. And he is prone. He is lying down. And he can't close his eyes.
Right.
Because...
Well, his eyelids have been removed.
Because his eyelids have been removed. In fact, everything has been removed, except for his hair.
Yeah.
Because there's been time... They don't have time here. There's been time where he's been existing like this. His hair is long and curled on his chest, whereas here it's just happened, so he still has his crazy Thomas Dolby hair. But I thought that putting the plastic mask was preparing us for that image of Mason, of the tightly, like there's no skin.
Yeah.
They've sort of grafted stuff over his bones.
Well, we have seen what he looks like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because we've seen an image of the new actor Mason Verger in his makeup for next season. Yeah.
I thought we were preparing us for that.
Ah, yes.
For that makeup.
Well, reveal. And I think that they didn't want to play that hand yet.
Yeah.
Because Mason still has a part to play in this series.
Yeah, I thought it gave you that impression of I no longer look like a person anymore.
But now he looks like a toy.
Yeah.
Hannibal's toy. And Margot's toy.
Oh, yeah.
But before Margot comes in, I love how Mason talks up Hannibal.
Mm-hmm.
How he benefited from his therapy. Oh, and yes. I was so hoping when I first saw this that he'd play his in the book, he has a come to Jesus thing.
Yeah.
And he's born again. And he has this wonderful line that plays on an old New York superstore called The Wiz.
Yes!
Where he says, nobody beats the Riz about the risen Jesus.
Yes.
And I was hoping that he'd go there, but he didn't. Instead, he went to, only I hope I can repay him someday.
Oh, I know. Which is wonderful foreshadowing indeed. For next season. Because you know, in that whack job little head of his, he's plotting revenge.
Already, yeah.
Yes.
And then now we get to talk about what Margot wants.
I want to talk about what Margot is wearing.
Well, please do.
Oh, yeah, go right ahead.
The gigantic gold neck choker thing.
The return of the collar. And I was confused. mostly because the last time we saw this extreme, she hasn't actually worn much neck jewelry since we saw her.
She hasn't.
In those gigantic silver, collar-like things where she was introduced. And granted, this wasn't as thick and heavy and confining looking, but I thought it was interesting that she went from this heavy, thick silver collar to, it's kind of more of a gold filigree type thing, where, but it's still a collar.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why would we bring this back if she's essentially free? Because she, and I'm like, well, even in the book, she wasn't with Mason in the bed. You know, even though we're giving the impression right now that he's like, well, you know, Margot is going to take care of me. And she's like, you know, he's like, oh, so now we talk about what Margot wants and that she's going to take care of him like he took care of her.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, she will.
Yes, she is. But I don't, I may be reading too much into it, but I thought it was very interesting to have her come in. She's got the blood red, dark red, like Du Maurier's.
It brings her back to a position of power.
Of power.
Because at the beginning, she was kind of drained, but she still had just attempted to kill her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had the idea of, well, I'll get pregnant. So she still had her power.
Mm-hmm.
And as we saw her later, she was diminished. So she was wearing more bland outfits.
Yeah.
And now she's back to that position. And now she is the verger in charge because her brother can do nothing.
She's the VIC?
Yes. Verger in charge.
I just thought it was interesting, though, to show her looking collared at a time where it seemed like she has the upper hand and is in a position of power. So visually, I found that very interesting. And I don't know whether it's because I have a connection with it in a different way, in that collared doesn't seem like being in a position of power. It could be that someone just thought it looked cool.
That could be.
Yeah. But I'm just saying that's the impression it gave me. That even though she's in this, you know, these strong colors, the dark blood red shirt and the red and the black, which is interesting to see who uses red and black in the show. But to have that gold color threw me off a little bit, and not in a bad way. It just made my brain think too much. And then we go back to
Hannibal and Will and Achilles and Patroclus. So Hannibal has been sketching Achilles lamenting the death of Patroclus.
Mm.
These are two characters from Greek mythology, two characters from the Iliad. And Patroclus was known for his empathy. So Patroclus obviously will.
Yes.
And Hannibal fancies himself Achilles.
Yeah.
Who had a weakness, if I recall. But he just glosses right over that.
Oh, yes.
And talks about the glory of Achilles and Patroclus wanting to bring down Troy alone.
Yeah.
And how the gods had to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so interesting that Hannibal doesn't see what he has set up.
Mm-hmm.
That there is divine intervention to bring them down.
Mm-hmm.
And that Achilles has a major weakness, like a major weakness.
He doesn't bring up how Achilles died in battle.
Right.
He only brings up how
Patroclus.
Patroclus does that. You know, he was hiding. He went out in Achilles' armor and was mistaken for him and killed in battle.
So when Will went out and pretended to be Hannibal,
hiding and revealing identity is a common theme in Greek mythology. And I loved that because that's essentially what Will is doing right now. And I was like, is Hannibal showing his hand?
He is. Oh, yeah. I think Hannibal feels like Will has to die.
Mm-hmm.
As much as he doesn't want to, I think he feels like he has to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a fascinating discussion, this idea that Hannibal's gift to Jack should be revealing himself as the Chesapeake Ripper.
Yeah.
To allow Jack closure.
You have teased him long enough.
But you don't really get the idea of what Will anticipates the result of that will be, because Hannibal's revealing could only amount to Jack's death.
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting, too. I was sort of like, what the... So you can't get a confession or get Hannibal in a position where his guilt can be revealed. So you're just going to have him tell Jack that he's Chesapeake Ripper.
Just go confess.
You don't see how this can go all kinds of wrong.
Well, I think it depends on how we feel Will is playing the game at this point.
Mm-hmm.
If Will is Hannibal's guy, Will could see this as a solution to a problem.
Mm.
if Will is Jack's guy, he could feel like he is the invincible one, just like Hannibal does, yeah. and can jump in and save the day and take care of this. Because his plan didn't work. Mason Verger is not dead and is not admitting what Hannibal did to him.
Exactly, because he has other plans.
So really, this is Endgame.
Yeah.
There are no more plans. Mm-hmm. We need to see this through to the end.
Oh, one thing I want to point out, too, that I thought was really... I don't want to leave out.
No, yeah.
Is that Hannibal says, Jack has become a friend.
Jack has become a friend. And
I owe him the truth.
Yeah. And so, if that is not the best setup for that opening sequence...
You can't handle the truth.
Well, I don't think Jack can handle the truth, honestly.
Apparently. As we saw at the beginning of episode one, we see how he handles the truth.
Indeed. So, we are here. We are here. We are ready.
Yes.
So you at home, eattherootcast@gmail.com is our email. You can follow us on Twitter at eattherootcast and eattherootcast.tumblr.com, which tomorrow, or by the time you hear this, may be teeming with new content now that Miko will have full, unbridled access to the world of Hannibal on the internet.
Unbridled.
Unfettered. Ready to go. You can see all the weird portraits of Will and Hannibal jacking each other off. It's going to be
so
quite
much
the day.
So much anime.
So much anime.
Wow.
I can't wait.
Thank you for joining us at the table. Welcome to Eat the Rootcast.
Oh, no.
We're off.
I'm caffeinated.
Oh, good. I'm glad. No long discussions about things we don't know the answer to.
We thought we had overconfidence in the internet. Yes.
I did have overconfidence.
We thought that in the time we had that discussion, we would have the answer because it's happened before.
Or overconfidence in my Google Foo.
Well, we can probably still find the answer. Just not tonight.
Yes.
Not this night.
No. I'm close, though.
You're listening to a Swingset podcast at swingset.fm.